Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University in cooperation with European Studies at Boston University and the Goethe Institute, Boston. Tonight's discussion is titled, The U.S. and Europe, Still Sharing the Same Values? Speaking will be Quentin Peel, International Affairs Editor of the Financial Times, and Peter Schneider, author and current Roth Distinguished Writer-in-Residence at Georgetown University. We begin with an introduction by Institute Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
My name is Irina Grudzinska-Gross. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute for Human Sciences in Boston University, the main organizer of this event. And one sentence about our institute. It serves as a forum for new nonpartisan debate, research, and education in matters of international, especially transatlantic relations. Tonight's event is entitled The U.S. and Europe Still Still Sharing the Same Values. It is organized in cooperation with the Goethe Institute Boston, and we are very grateful for their support, and also with the newly established European Studies Program here at Boston University, with which we look forward to a long collaboration. It is the 13th in a series of lectures and panel discussions launched by our institute in response to the growing tensions between the United States and Europe. To speak about these tensions, their nature, and possible resolutions, we have here with us this evening two very distinguished guests, two Europeans coming each from a different country. Peter Schneider, the Berlin-based author and journalist, and frequent contributor to the New York Times, and Quentin Peel, international affairs editor of the Financial Times, whose Thursday column I'm sure you all know. Let me briefly present the speakers. Quentin Peel has worked at the Financial Times since 1975, and he served there successively as Southern Asia correspondent, Africa editor, European Community correspondent, and Brussels bureau chief, Moscow correspondent, and chief correspondent in Germany. On his return to London in 1994, approximately after 20 years in various places, he became foreign editor running the international reporting operations of the Financial Times. He took up his present position as international affairs editor in September 1998. I hope it's all true. That I said. Now, Peter Schneider is the author of over 20 novels, screenplays, and volumes of journalistic essays, several of which have been translated into English. One of his best-known books is the novel entitled The Wall Jumper. He was a central figure in the 1968 student protest movement in Berlin and in northern Italy, and has greatly contributed to the literary and cultural life in Germany over the last four decades. He is currently a Roth Distinguished Writer in Residence at Georgetown University, and we are very honored and happy to have both of you here today. Peter Schneider will be the first speaker. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm glad to be here. It has been some time. I had the privilege to be at Harvard in 1990, half a year after the fall of the wall, and actually I had to talk about the fall of the wall, and of course anybody in Berlin knew more about it than me, who was talking about it in Boston. Today, you have the dubious privilege to hear Peter Schneider almost without any note and script, for a simple reason. I have a new computer. And I was so engaged before I came here that I said, okay, I will spoil you with a written speech, which I did. It's in the computer. It's here. But for reasons I don't want to explain to you, it would take probably the whole 20 minutes, it doesn't come out of the computer. There's no way to connect me to the internet and so forth and so on. So I'm rather, you know, lost Peter Schneider alone in Boston. I think what we are debating today has come a long way. It is not just the Iraq war that has divided Europe and the United States. I think the Iraq war has worked like a magnifying glass that has brought forward tensions and divisions of a deeper dimension. It's actually about life, about religion, about how to live your life, and especially not to forget how long you want to live your life. It's about smoking, about sex, actually about everything that is important in life. And of course, we cannot investigate all of these divisions in detail. Also, it's quite, I think, amusing. For instance, one of the riddles to me is, why is it that you have on both sides of the Atlantic rather informed populations who both know that it is dangerous to smoke? And why is it that on one side of the Atlantic people really have stopped smoking to the point where you risk your life if you light a cigarette in the street, and in Europe, especially in the so-called New Europe, they smoke like devils. Why is it? It means something which is not so easy to understand, and we leave it there for now. But as for the recent relations between the United States and Europe, we have, of course, to start with September 11. And since I'm not alone with the idea that this vicious attack was not only targeting the World Trade Center, but it was targeting the souls and the minds of the Western civilization. We can ask, so how did we do with this test? It was a terrible test for our view about our civilization, about democracy, about how to react and how to deal with such a new threat. Let me first start with telling a success story. It is almost forgotten now that the reaction after September 11 on both sides of the Atlantic was rather the same. In Berlin, for instance, where I come from, I've seen with my own eyes, because I was there, 10,000 of Berliners expressing their loyalty and their concern about what happened in New York the very day. And I've seen people weeping and many flowers, and there was a readiness to help and to be engaged and whatever was needed to be done to be with the Americans to do it. we should remember the line in Le Monde, which said, "Nous sommes tous des Américains." It was a line that said, we all feel the same about that, and this is an attack not only to the business center of New York or of the United States, it is an attack against everything we stand for. And I think the world and Europe understood the new quality of this crime. Let me be very clear about this point. In order to commit a new crime, you need to have a formula. The new formula that Osama bin Laden came up with was the following. And I remember it was one sentence. And it said, every taxpayer in this Western world is a legitimate military target. What was new about it? It was not new that civilian populations have been killed because they were there when the war took place. This has always happened. But so far, most war leaders, warlords, and even most dictators shied away from publicly declaring every civilian is a legitimate military target. This was new, and it is a new kind of crime, and I think the world understood it, and I repeat it here in order to make clear that I'm the last person to diminish the threat. I'm not a friend of Michael Moore and many peaceniks in Germany who think that the threat is invented. I'm not on the side of, I'm afraid to say, many Germans who believe that, not only Germans, many French, many Italians, who believe that the attack of September 11 was invented by the CIA or some other agency. It is silly, and I'm ashamed to report it, but it is true that these beliefs are popular in Europe and even more so in the Muslim world. So this said, I make it very short with the success story. The success story was that the Bush administration also, it was using some terrible notions like crusade and infinite justice and so forth. I think with some caution and a coherent strategy, tried to bring together the allies to react towards this challenge. And so the war in Afghanistan took place. I, for one, was for that war, and many Germans with me. And by the way, since American media so easily forget anything non-American, the Germans fought in this war from day one. And now they are the second largest military force in Afghanistan. So far, the resume of the Transatlantic Alliance sounds rather pretty. We cannot say that the war in Afghanistan was a success. It is another unfinished job, especially due to the fact that another war was begun, which diverted so many American military forces that were needed in Afghanistan. Now 60% of Afghanistan is in the hand of warlords and drug lords, and bin Laden is still at large, and we are far from having the so much celebrated democracy, but we are coming closer to that. Now, the good resume, the nice resume, changes radically. When Bush started the Iraq War, there was an almost unanimous feeling between the European population. I'm not talking about the government. By the way, this a little vicious distinction between old and new Europe doesn't really hit the point, because the peoples in Europe all agreed to be against this war. Even the Poles, the British, the Spanish, the Italians, all which had governments that then took part in the war, they all were wholly against this war, and it was only governments who were divided about it. And suddenly, when it comes to Germany, this today almost unthinkable formula of Gerd Schröder, unconditional loyalty with the Americans, what he expressed after September 11, changed, and he made it clear that he was against this war. I leave many steps out, and I come to a different conclusion when it comes to the resume of the Iraq War. As a matter of fact, everyone now in the world, and even 60% of the Americans, agree now that this war was probably not worth the loss of lives and its costs, and that this war was fought for false or faked reasons. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. And this is actually disquieting enough that a whole, the biggest and oldest democracy in this world was misled by some people into a war that it actually never thought it was a necessary war, or it hardly believed that it was a necessary war. Now, if that happens, something so grave, it's all the more astonishing that the president who led the Americans and his allies into that war was reelected. It's all the more incredible that the Dr. Condoleezza Rice, who was responsible for the false information about weapons of mass destruction and the nuclear capacities of Saddam Hussein, was not fired afterwards when it became clear that this was wrong information. She was promoted. And it's even more astonishing and disquieting, not only for Americans, but for the whole democratic world, that a man who distinguished himself by justifying torture, redefining torture as something that is not torture as long as it is short of organ failure or death, somebody who declared that the Geneva Convention is obsolete in the case of members of Al-Qaeda, that this man was not fired but promoted. In earlier times, I remember times in America where it happened when a scandal was published and it became clear that it was a scandal, that there were lies, that there was misinformation, that a whole nation was misled, that it had consequences. Somebody was held accountable. Now we have a new situation that, yes, the scandal is open, everything is written about it, but the people who are responsible are promoted. It's a new way to make a career. And how can we explain this? I think here is it where Europe and United States are drifting apart. But in this moment, I must be very clear about one thing. I think since there has been made this distinction between the old and the new Europe, we can with much more reason talk about the old and the new America. Or the division that existed before the Civil War. In any case, I don't buy into the red state, blue state division. I know that any red state has a lot of blue parts, for heaven's sakes. And the same is true vice versa. But what we can say, using and abusing maybe a distinction of my friend Simon Sharma, we can distinguish worldly and godly America. I like these kind of salop, unscientific distinctions better because they don't have the authority. You don't have to take this so seriously because we don't know yet exactly what this division really is. But I make this distinction in order to say I'm convinced, and I will say some more words about it, that indeed America, godly, the official America, is drifting away. It's drifting away from the mainstream of Western democracies right now. But the other America that has lost now, narrowly lost, and Europe will come closer together. And I think we have to build bridges between Europe and the America that has lost. Stable bridges, because it might take a long time, maybe a decade or longer, until the balances are shifted again. And so this is only a short notice to what I'm going to say now. I think what has happened here, I was asking, why was it possible that everything that I have named here could happen and there was no accountability whatsoever? It could only happen, is my thesis, you might contradict me, because this administration viciously and clearly has abused the legitimate fears and the shock after September 11 to create a culture of fear. It's not a culture of life, it's a culture of fear. There was one moment when, I mean, let's face it, September 11, as terrible and a heinous and unique crime as it has been, it was 3.5 years away, and there's not a single day since these 3.5 years we don't hear American politicians say, we are at war. And they talk about the need to fight this war against terrorism. If I hear this by Republicans, I don't know whether my feeling is wrong. I feel that they say it even triumphantly. There's a kind of erotic vibrato in expressing, you know, we are at war, because this is a fantastic instrument. If you have an enemy who is not visible, has no territory, and has no constitution, no laws that he obeys, he can be everywhere and nowhere, and there is no way to know exactly what he is about to do and what you have to do in order to be prepared. It is a terrible instrument. How many policemen do you need in order to protect this building, to protect a square? How many policemen do you need to protect an inauguration? Is it 1,000, 10,000, 100,000? You can convince me of any number. And even the experts, they are just guessing. They don't know. It's a fantastic instrument in order to create a culture of fear, and I see this a big part of this country crippled by fear. This is not talking about a preventive war. I'm talking about preventive life. There are so many examples. If you take an airplane, as I did today, you hear a voice suddenly. It says, you are not allowed for no reason whatsoever to leave your seat half an hour before the landing. Or there's another announcement, you're not allowed to leave it after departure. So I was curious, why is that? There must be a reason. But actually, the first thing was, nobody asks questions anymore. There's a command and you obey. You are already a soldier. You already have lost your quality as a citizen. You don't ask the question, why is that? And does it make any sense? I asked the steward, and he said, of course, you know, it comes from the, what's the name of the? Patriarch, but I'm not entitled to give you further explanations. And then, of course, my neighbors were asking two questions, and a certain discussion began. But, you know, I think it's very dangerous if we stop to ask questions and engage in this culture of fear with which you can justify everything. New Year's Eve, I spent in New York. And by the way, to make this little remark, and I have to stop now, when it comes to weather reports, we make this distinction between, in German there's a nice word, I like it, gefühlte Temperatur und die wirkliche Temperatur, which means the felt temperature, the perceived temperature, and the real, the measured temperature. The same distinction should be applied to fear. If you have to do with a threat like I have explained, I tried to explain to you, the distinction between the windshield threat and the real threat is just enormous. It can be 90, it can be 150%. To give you an example, New York, and I will tell my little story, the cities who really lived through the terror, New York City, New Jersey, Washington, they all have overwhelmingly voted for people who did not engage in the culture of fear. They voted Democratic. The people who had only heard the news of terror by the speeches of George W. Bush and his people and saw it in TV, they voted for the fear factor. And this is just an example how extremely different the felt, the perceived threat and the real threat can be. And I don't want to go any longer here. I just want to conclude with a perspective. I think some ism is growing up here. Something, I don't know how to call this ism yet, but something is growing here. This country is in a danger, and I think that Europe and worldly America will need to come closer together. We must build bridges. We must develop an autonomous policy for all the questions that are existential for us, like Iraq, like Israel and Palestine, and, of course, the fight against terrorism. But we must defend something that we have inherited by the Enlightenment, which I call secular humanism. We have to defend this, and it might be a big fight. Thank you.
This is a great demonstration of European solidarity that Peter and I are sharing the same watch to time the speaker. Well, I'm delighted to be here in Boston and delighted, thank you very much for the invitation. It's lovely for me to be back because actually I did my first journalistic job in this town. I was for 6 weeks one summer back in 1967, a copy kid on the Christian Science Monitor. And so I discovered the delights of Dunkin' Donuts and other things, which was about all I could afford at the time. What I'll be able to do is, in a way, complement Peter's presentation and unpick a bit more of some of the differences and perhaps some of the similarities that we have in our concept of values. I think I might actually disagree ever so slightly with Peter, perhaps fundamentally with Peter, on, in a way, one direction in which your conclusions, Peter, were leading, which was that basically Europe's got to do a deal with good Democrats because that's where sanity lay, and the Republicans are perhaps out of the spectrum. Because I actually think that the differences that have emerged in our perception of values are quite profound and go beyond any partisan divide in America. But let me begin like this. The question is, do we still share the same values? And to that, my immediate answer is yes, without any question. We do share the same fundamental values. Essentially, the values of the Enlightenment, with a strong influence, I think, of our Christian, perhaps our Judaic heritage too. We believe in democracy. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in the sanctity of human life. I hope we do. We believe in the freedom of the individual. We believe in freedom of religion, freedom of speech. And we all actually very much believe in free markets and free trade. It's quite surprising how similarly we see these things. We may differ in degree, but the goals are broadly similar. And most of us would still, I think, say with Voltaire, "I disagree with everything you've said, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." I think there's, between both of our worlds, the world of America and the world of Europe, there is a very strong stress on individual rights and individual freedoms, which is a big difference in our value systems to many other parts of the world, where there's much more stress on communal and social values. Where we differ, though, I think, and it's very important where we differ, is that I think we differ on how we achieve these fundamental goals. And I think we also differ in the absolutism with which perhaps we're prepared to pursue them. And let me explore that a little bit more. Because we differ in the means of getting to our ends quite often. And indeed, sometimes the choice of the means can actually undermine the end we're seeking. And I take the obvious example straight away of the war in Iraq. I think there was overwhelming agreement in both Europe and America that Saddam Hussein was a ghastly dictator and everybody would be better off without him. And there was overwhelming agreement, probably too, that Iraq would be much better off if it had some sort of democratic system. Where we disagreed, and I totally take what Peter said about the extent of European feeling in every country in Europe about this, we disagreed about how to get rid of Saddam Hussein and how to turn Iraq into a democracy. Europeans were very opposed to military intervention. They said it was the wrong way to do it because it could precipitate a worse disaster than it actually tried to replace. And I suspect that many Europeans today think that that's exactly what's happening. Let us pray that it isn't and hope that the elections produce a better result, but it doesn't look very good. And I wanted to start with this difference, in a way, in the perceptions of using military force to solve problems, because it's a very clear dividing line, I think, between Europe today and the US as it seems to be. Many of you may have seen the results of the German Marshall Fund poll they did last year when they asked, under some conditions, do you believe that war is necessary to obtain justice? And they got startlingly different replies. 82% of the US replies said, yes, war was justified. But in Germany, only 31% said it was justified. In France, 33%. In Spain, only 25%. The British were slightly different. They're a bit more militaristic in their traditions. 69%, quite a lot less than America, but 69% said in some circumstances war was justified. Does it represent a big difference in our values or just a temporary split? I think it is actually very profound because it's a reflection very much of the experiences of Europe throughout the 20th century. And I think the difference that we perceive there between continental Europe and Britain and between Europe and America is that Britain was never occupied during any of the wars of the 20th century, and nor was America. But all those countries who really experienced war in their backyard have really got a very sharp feeling about it. Actually, I was very struck by a friend of mine who was a former minister in Poland, who, when talking at the time of Poland signing up to the coalition in Iraq and going to war, said, but actually, we must admit this is not a popular thing to do in Poland, and I'll tell you why. You in Britain and those people in America think of war as something that happens a long way away from home. But in Poland, if we think of tanks, we think of our own back street. And that's a deep, deep thing, I think, throughout Europe. The second significant area of difference I thought I'd underline is our perceptions, again, means rather than ends, of the role of government. Again, a very clear divide between America's perceptions of what government is about and Europe's perceptions. 58% of Americans think that government's primary function should be to stay out of the hair of the individual, keep out of our lives. Only 34% said that it was more important that government should provide a safety net for the poorest and the most miserable. And it's completely the other way around in Europe. Literally, two-thirds of Europeans say government should be providing a safety net for people who can't manage themselves. And only a third actually think that actually less government is a much better thing. And then we have the difference, again, in our belief in the use of multilateral institutions, that the Europeans are much more enthusiastic about doing things through the United Nations or any of its agencies. In Germany, if you ask Germans, do they regard the United Nations favorably or unfavorably? 71% say the United Nations is a great thing. 67% in France, 64% in the UK, and only 50% in America. And it's a very different perception. One of the big rows we've been having over the last 2 or 3 years has been about the International Criminal Court, something that one would have thought would be a very positive creation, a court that could try the worst of war criminals, people like Saddam Hussein, people like Slobodan Milosevic, after what they've done in their countries. This would actually give some teeth to a system that would discourage dictators from, if they knew they could be held to account afterwards. And yet in America, absolute resistance to it. It's a fascinating division. The question was asked in an opinion poll whether you actually believe that international criminal courts have the right to try your soldiers. Now, as you very well know, America doesn't like that idea at all. Only 37% of people in America thought that was in any way a good idea. But in Europe, take France. 71% of the people in France said, yes, it's right that a court, an international court, should try our own soldiers if they misbehave. 65% in Germany. Very big difference, really. Part of it goes down to national pride. And part of it goes down to a sort of feeling of perhaps the feeling that one has in America more and more, that American exclusiveness, of American a Sonderweg almost for America, as they used to complain in Germany, that there was too much of a Sonderweg for Germany. The question was asked also, does our way of life need to be protected against foreign influence? And 64% of people in America said, yes, it does. Russia was even higher. 78% of the Russians wanted protection for their way of life. And Britain, France, and Germany, almost identical. They still want protection, but only 50%, much lower. They're much less conscious of the need to protect their way of life from outside foreign influences. But it's not a simple picture. Because in another way, Europeans are much less tolerant of minorities than Americans are. Americans actually were asked the question, do you think that African Americans and Hispanics are a good influence or a bad influence in society? Overwhelmingly, the answer was a good influence. 78% said African Americans are a good thing. But in Germany, the same question was asked about the Turks. Only 47% thought Turks were a good influence in society. 41% said bad. At least it was still a majority. In France, about North Africans, 43% said they were a good influence and 51% said a bad influence. So Europeans, not very tolerant of minorities. We're more tolerant of other things. We're more tolerant of homosexuals than American society is. So it's a very mixed picture. And it's not clear. And how do we untangle the differences? Because I think there's another key element where we differ. We differ in the intensity with which we hold these values that we hold in common. And I think we differ in a way in the absolutism we feel about these values. I think Europeans are fundamentally much less certain about being right. Take the concept of freedom or liberty. Now, those were the words that were repeated, I think, more than 40 times by President Bush in his inaugural address, freedom and liberty. And he never sought at any stage to define what he meant by freedom or liberty. He just took it absolutely for granted that his audience would know what freedom is or liberty is. But I don't think in Europe a European could have made the same speech. They would have sought to define the concept and said that what is this freedom I'm talking about? I think there was... I know that President Bush's speech certainly didn't go down uniquely well with all of America. Indeed, I was rather interested to see that many conservatives thought he'd gone over the top. I think they were more concerned at this idea that somehow America will now transform the world with its own values, and there is a caution now about doing that. But in Europe, people would have said, what do you mean by freedom? What is freedom? Are you free if you're miserably poor? Is freedom simply having a democratic system? And does that mean multi-party democracy or what? And just look around the world a little bit at sort of forms of democracy. Uganda is a lovely country in Africa that I know well, and it's had a pretty terrible track record. One of its greatest problems is the degree of tribalism in the country. So President Museveni in Uganda decided that he was going to have a system which he described as no-party democracy. No parties would be allowed because he was really worried that the moment you set up parties in Africa, it just splits along tribal lines and actually ends up in civil war. Is no-party democracy worse than multi-party democracy? Or what if you have democracy but have rampant corruption? Take Pakistan, Nigeria, Ghana. All those countries had civilian, democratically elected governments who were hopelessly corrupt. And in every one of those countries, a military coup happened to overthrow the corrupt civilians and attempt to get rid of the corruption. Now, which is better in a country? Are you freer if you have a totally corrupt government that's elected or a military government that's less corrupt? I don't think there's an easy answer. I think I suspect, on the whole, that I would still prefer the corrupt democratic government. But there's a degree of corruption which becomes, they're just stealing our money. I don't think that's freedom. So I think it's a very difficult question and not a straightforward choice. And I think Europeans would agonize before they preached, which Mr. Bush clearly didn't do. I think European uncertainty is reflected in another clear divide, which Peter certainly mentioned, the attitude to religion. The question was asked by the Pew Survey of Global Attitudes, do you have to believe in God to be moral? That's a very good question, a very tough question. And in the US, 58% said, yes, you have to believe in God to be moral. What a huge divide, 40% said no. But it was absolutely the opposite in Europe. 73% in Britain said, no way, you do not have to believe in God to be moral. 86% in France, 66% in Germany. They're a bit more religious in Germany. And interestingly on this one, where there are often quite big divides between Eastern and Western Europe, Eastern Europe is also very much in the same camp as Western Europe, quite secular, quite committed. Even in deeply Catholic Poland, 60% of the population said, no, you do not have to believe in God to be moral. And I think that's certainly a factor, that different perception, that greater secularism in Europe and greater belief in the necessity of religion in America, which was a factor in the European hostile reaction to President Bush's very clear division of the world into good and evil, or his use of that phrase, the axis of evil, to describe people. This clarity that there is something that is totally definably evil. I think we see things much more in Europe in shades of grey. I think we're also less absolute, for example, in our attitudes to crime and punishment. It shows in the European rejection of the death penalty. We don't like the absolutism of saying you die for that offence. And we believe that so strongly that to allow Turkey even to negotiate membership in the European Union, we've insisted that the Turks abolish the death penalty. And it's the same with sending people to prison. We were told a slightly surprising statistic the other day that 5 times more people are sent to jail relatively in America than they are in Britain, and our jails are overcrowded already. It's a very mixed picture. I think there's great confusion over the values we share and the values that seem to divide us. And I think the problem is that we do think we share the same values, and then we find it baffling when we're divided, and actually get rather angry because we don't. We said, but hang on, we think the same things. In some ways, Europeans are much more conservative than Americans. We don't permit new products to come on the market, like genetically modified foods, unless they can be proved safe. It's what we call the precautionary principle. It's causing fury in America. It's causing big trade rows because the American attitude is much more, we will allow something new unless it's actually proved to be dangerous. Suddenly our value difference becomes a trade war. And that's causing a problem as well. Why don't we understand each other better? I think, in conclusion, I'd just say this. I think we take each other far too much for granted. I think we know each other, and we don't. And because we think we know each other, we don't inquire enough. I'm quite worried that I feel that there's a whole generation of young Europeans who are not very interested in travelling to America. And I suspect it's slightly true, vice versa. Young Americans, not very interested in travelling to Europe. We take each other for granted. We find each other a bit boring. Asia is so much more exotic. I mean, when I left school, one of the places I had to go was come to America. Went to work at the Christian Science Monitor. My kids expressed no interest at all. They went off to India, Southeast Asia, Australia, round the world. Okay, round the world, they happened to come back through America, but it was almost by mistake. So I wonder if I'm reminded of that saying that we used to say about Britain and America, that we are divided by a common language. I wonder today if we shouldn't rephrase that and say the trouble with Europe and America is we're divided by our common values. And that's rather a dangerous situation. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University in cooperation with European Studies at Boston University and the Goethe Institute Boston. Tonight's discussion was titled, The U.S. and Europe, Still Sharing the Same Values? We just heard from Peter Schneider, author and current Roth Distinguished Writer in Residence at Georgetown University. Earlier, we heard from Quentin Peel, International Affairs Editor of the Financial Times. We began with an introduction by Institute Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.